Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hi, folks. Glad to be with my wonderful audience, people genuinely concerned about mental health and psychological issues and living life, people genuinely concerned about the plight of people called patients, called psychiatric patients and psychiatric inmates who so commonly are getting injured by drugs, by shock treatment. Just today I did a consultation with a man who was seriously injured by shock and seriously then developed tardive dyskinesia. The destruction being caused around the world by psychiatry is really quite unfathomable. And by the way, folks, we will be announcing soon the details, but let me tell you about it right now. I'm going to be in Copenhagen, and then I'm going to be in London. I'm going to be speaking in Copenhagen September 14th of this year, and then I'm going to go to London and speak there on September 18th. The sponsor who really got this going is Peter Gercha, who is a physician who does an enormous amount of research in the field of medicine, and who started then researching psychiatric drugs and was just appalled by what he found. So he's developed an interest in my work, and I have an interest in his work. But I'll tell you more about that. But maybe if you want to save dates, you could save either or both September 18th, did I say? I got to go back and check my book. First day of the week of the 14th, it's September 14th in Denmark, and then September 18th in London. I'm a little bit less focused at this moment because before I came on the air, I was talking with this man and his and a family member about what had happened to him, and I got so involved in talking to him about how he'd been harmed that for the first time in my life, I actually forgot the show for a minute, and I had my alarms turned off. So here I am. My guest today, again, is Jeffrey Mason, M-A-S-S-O-N. Those of you who have heard earlier shows with Jeffrey know that he's a man of just, you know, wide caring. He cares. And wide thoughtfulness over many fields. He's written books critical of Freud for betraying women by making believe that they lusted after or fantasized about their fathers and their uncles and so on, rather than that they were being abused. He wrote a book that I may have him back on in a future date to talk about, called Against Therapy, which is a critique of psychotherapy and raises many valid issues. And then he decided to write about what he wanted to write about. So he began writing about animals. And I've read more books by him than by any other author. First, because I got started looking at these books about therapy and Freud, but then I got excited and interested in reading and enjoying his animal books. I think Jeffrey and I both found that animals and thinking and writing about animals is a lot more fun than thinking about psychiatry, writing about psychiatry. Jeffrey also found out that he could write bestsellers. And he has got books that we're going to be talking about today, the kind of that orientation at least, called When Elephants Weep, Dogs Never Lie About Love, The Dog Who Couldn't Stop Loving, and now a book about humans and how violent they are compared to other animals called beasts. Jeff, are you there?
I'm here, Peter.
I got to see your picture on Skype, but I was afraid to turn on my picture because I don't know how that would work with being on the radio. So I decided I enjoyed looking at you for a few minutes, but you're gone now, so I don't see you.
I turned it off for the same reason. I thought we'd probably get better sound if we turned off the video.
Well, you sound great. Folks, this man's in Spain right now, and then you're going to move with your wife to Germany in a while, but right now he's in Spain enjoying himself and doing a lot of radio with me. Because I really want to document Jeff's views on a number of things, and then we'll present them for free as a package about Jeffrey Mason's work. I've gotten extremely interested in evolution. Those of you who have read my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, where I try to show that these are actually evolutionary phenomena. We develop guilt, shame, and anxiety in part as a kind of anger management. A way of controlling our violence when we also so much want intimacy. And then I've gotten very interested in dogs from a much more sensitive and aware way over the years reading Jeffrey's books. And I'm now thinking about, I'm working on the story of humans and dogs going back in evolution. I think it's going to be more like a novel than anything else. But I'm working on this. Who knows what will come of the project. But it made me think, gosh, I want to talk with Jeffrey not about Against Therapy, which was our original thought, but let's talk some more about humans and animals and their thoughts and their feelings and evolution and how we got together. Because I think our meeting dogs was the biggest leap in our cultural evolution. And with that thought, I hand the microphone over to my friend Jeffrey Mason. Jeff, your thoughts.
Well, I think you may well be right, Peter. I think we discussed it a couple of shows ago about how the dating of humans and dogs coming together is being pushed back all the time. It used to be seen as 10,000 years, then it was 15. Now it's more likely to be 35,000 to 50,000. And since 50,000 years ago is when humans became what we know of today as modern humans, Homo sapiens sapiens, it would appear that we co-evolved right from the very beginning with dogs as our closest companions. And there are people that believe that's what gave us the edge over the Neanderthals, who were bigger, stronger, more intelligent, but didn't have dogs.
I think there's a question about whether they were more intelligent, but they were certainly bigger and stronger. Now, that's an interesting book that you're talking about, and I read it because you mentioned it on the last show, but now I forget the name of it. You'll remember about the that our big advantage over the Neanderthals was the dogs for hunting, basically hunting mastodons.
Yeah, I have not actually seen the book. I was in correspondence with her when I was doing Beasts.
Give me her name. Let's honor her with her name on the radio.
I'm just trying to remember. I've blanked on it too, but
you'll get it.
In a minute.
It's a new book out, and you can find it. But she focuses exclusively on basically the dogs helped us hunt and be at the top of the food chain, in particular hunt mastodons. I think dogs did so much more for us than that. And that's where Jeffrey and I have thought a lot about. And, you know, Jeff, talk about dogs teaching us about friendship and love. What do you think?
You know, I've been thinking, one of the things I didn't do in When Elephants Weep was I didn't speculate, partly because I was writing the book with a much more scientific person, Susan McCarthy. But I, at the time, remember thinking, and now I'm thinking about even more, that there are some emotions for which animals are better examples than humans. That is, they feel those emotions more profoundly even than humans do. And my prime example, of which I'm constantly reminded whenever I see dogs, is that dogs have a greater capacity for friendship and all the emotions that surround friendship. So I would call it something like friendliness. And dogs are simply more friendly than any humans I've ever met. And all of the listeners will realize this if they just think for a moment about what a dog does when they see another dog. If I'm driving in the car with my dog and he spots another dog, which of course all the time, it's like, stop, Jeff, stop the car. There's a dog out there. They just can't get enough of other dogs. They love seeing them, and the encounters are, I would say, 99% friendly, tail wagging, let's play. They communicate all kinds of information to one another, and they're tireless for this. Now, many dogs are equally that way with humans. That is, I was at the beach the other day, and I saw this small dog looking around with such pleasure on his face, watching everybody play volleyball and different ball games. And it's like, this is where I want to be. I belong here. These are my people. And he looks so comfortable and so at home. And I thought, you know, he has no problems walking up to anybody, wagging his tail, making friends with them, far more than any humans could do. I was at that same beach. I didn't go up to anybody I didn't know and say, hi, I'm Jeff. Who are you? And, you know, where the dogs can do that. So I think to some extent they've developed this capacity for getting on with one another and with a member of a different species, namely us, in a much more profound way than we humans have. And I think that's something very important that we could learn from dogs if we observe them in a different way, which a lot of people are now beginning to do. I'm sure you know, Peter, that now Harvard has a dog laboratory and various universities have laboratories in which people bring in their dogs for a few hours and scientists study their extraordinary capacities.
It's interesting what you're saying. I think there's some variability among dogs. I have two Shetland sheepdogs, and both of them are much more interested in each other and in us than in other animals. So, and I think that might be a bit of a Shetland sheepdog or Sheltie characteristic. So when we're walking, the younger one, who was a runt of the litter, she's a small even for a Sheltie, avoids other dogs. And the older one, her great-grandmother, will definitely show an interest in other dogs, but it is a little wary as she shows the interest. So okay. I think
of course, there is tremendous variation, but I guess I'm so impressed. I've been to a number of dog parks, and you know that may be a self-selected group of dogs, but yeah. I noticed that almost all the dogs there, especially after they understand the purpose of it, they just go from dog to dog, wagging their tails and meeting and greeting. And it's just astonishing to me that they're capable of doing that, because we are not. We just couldn't do that. You couldn't arrive in a completely strange city and just start walking up to everyone you meet and start chatting with them. I mean, there are a few people that try that, but it's not always successful, whereas dogs are much more successful. But I think you're right. I think there are breed differences. And the dog I have lived with for the last 6 or 7 years is a golden lab, and he just loves everybody and every other animal, not just dogs. He's very friendly. If you show him a baby rat, he'll lick the rat. He likes rabbits. He likes all cats. I don't think he's ever met another animal that he doesn't like.
When I think that your point is the more important one, but I just wanted to bring up the fact that not all dogs are quite like that, or it might puzzle some of the listeners. But I think your basic point is that dogs have a quality human beings don't. And I was trying to imagine what a human being acting as friendly as a dog would look like. Why, he'd look like he was having a manic episode and he'd get locked up.
That's right. What's wrong with him? He has no boundaries.
That's exactly what would happen.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Peter. So, and, you know, that does raise. I mean, I also was, what was I reading today about electroshock? And I'm sure you follow this. My good friend John Reed, who's at Melbourne at the university there, sent me some material, and various people from around the United States and other countries, an anti-electric shock they were having, I think 10 cities, they were having demonstrations against it. And there was Ted Chapasinski, whom I'm sure you know very well, and I knew briefly when I lived in Berkeley. And he was recounting how Loretta Bender, a psychiatrist in America, had given him electroshock torture sessions when he was 6 years old. And, you know, I could not help but think that no animal is sadistic in this way. And it does raise, I mean, friendliness is one thing, but what is it, Peter? And I think you and I have talked a bit about this. I don't think we'll ever find an answer, but what allows so many members of our species to be sadistic in ways that no member of any other species is? You don't hear, I mean, there are animals that fight, of course. There are other top predators who have this us-them reaction and don't want strangers in their territory. But very rarely do you hear of animals killing one another in the organized kind of way that we do, or engaging in the kind of us-them which leads them to totally dehumanize or what's the correct word? One wolf making another wolf not a wolf.
Objectify in a way.
I suppose, dehumanize, it's a form of objectification.
Dehumanize,
and what really got to me about this, Peter, is the recognition that the other greatest predator on Earth, beside human, is the orca. And nobody has ever heard of one orca in the wild killing another orca. So in the 20th century alone, we've killed 200 million of our fellow humans. And during that period, the same period of time, orcas have killed exactly none, zero. So it does raise, and you can't say, I mean, I've argued with this about scientists, and they say, well, they just don't have the intelligence for that. I'm sorry, what kind of intelligence is it that allows you to kill 200 million people? Yeah. And of course, orcas are very large brain mammals, have extraordinary means of communication. They're extremely sociable, and they manage to live in the ocean without killing one another. And you know, if you look at all the other apex predators, the predators at the top of the food chain, wolves and bears and the big cats, you very, very rarely hear of interspecies killing. And of course, they don't kill other species unless they are eating them. They don't do it for sport. They don't do it casually. And of course, many of the large animals, what we call the charismatic megafauna, like elephants and giraffes and gorillas, are pure vegans. They don't kill any animal ever for any reason, unless directly attacked, and even then very rarely. So the deeper lesson for me, which I don't know how we're going to get it extracted from them, is what enables all these animals to live in a certain kind of peacefulness, even if you describe it as indifference to other animals, whereas we seem unable to do this. You know, with our great capacity for empathy, which some of us do have, others do not, of course, others it gets blocked. But in spite of the fact that, for example, elephants may not be empathic towards humans, they don't attack us in the way we attack them, even though they pose no danger to us. And that's the question that's really preoccupied me now for a few years. I can't get an answer. But I feel that if we would open our minds to the possibility that other animals have access to emotions that we don't, and that some emotions that we know they feel more profoundly than we do. I mentioned the example of dogs, even cats. I mean, I've lived with cats most of my life, and they're very, of course, as everyone knows, very, very different from dogs. But they have this capacity for simple contentment, greater than any human's capacity for that. I think elephants probably have a greater capacity for mourning than do humans. I think wolves, too. like dogs, from whom they descend to some extent, have this capacity for enormous friendship within the pack, and also for loyalty within the pack. The male leader of the pack suffers babies to jump all over him, to bite him, to do absolutely anything without losing his temper. So there does seem to be almost no animal that doesn't have some emotion that seems stronger than our own. And that I think that's a real injury to our narcissism. We don't like to even contemplate it. But I think if we would open our minds to that, we could learn something.
I've got a couple of thoughts on that, and I don't want to lose track of the issue of how dogs are in many ways more loving than we are, because I want to hear more of your thoughts about that too. But you know, if you look at evolution and you think, well, why would natural selection have favored our being so intra-species violent? Certainly, there were many different forms of human beings right up until about somewhere between 20, 30, 40, 50,000 years ago when the last of the Neanderthals disappeared. So we're coexistent with the Neanderthals. I've seen other people, other estimates that we were coexistent with, I think it's Homo habilis at one point, which is an earlier human who looked a lot like us, more perhaps than the I think I have that right, Homo habilis, than the Neanderthals. And perhaps that the twist that's in our evolution is that being violent toward anybody who looked kind of like us and wasn't a member of our clan had some huge survival value, perhaps. My own thinking is that guilt, shame, and anxiety basically didn't extend to people outside the clan, that we felt guilt, shame, and anxiety in our personal relationships with our immediate dependencies, with our initial strong dependent relationships, and then the ones around us, the extended family, and that had huge survival value, but extending it to Neanderthals or Homo habilis or even to other human beings in different clans, maybe it didn't have survival value for us then. Now, of course, it's huge survival value because we don't live together better. We're going to keep on destroying each other, and we are going to have an ultimate holocaust of the whole species at some point, if not from atomic weapons, then from manufactured diseases or something else. But I think there is a partial solution in evolution that, by God, we got to the top of the humans and wiped the rest of them out, and that had evolutionary value until we got so powerful that that we can literally wipe each other out. Have you thought of it that way at all, or looked at that concept?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the criticisms, I mean, when I do tell scientists about my hypothesis, or you know, notice the fact that orcas don't kill one another, one of the things that people who study orcas point out to me is they do fight, but they and they have discovered. Nobody's ever seen it, but they've certainly found marks on orcas which could only have come from other orcas. So evidently they do fight, but they don't kill one another. And one of the reasons they've given me for that is that they live in this environment where they simply, all they have to do is get out of the way. And
well, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I think that was probably true for humans for a very long period of time. I mean, basically, until we had agriculture, until we were settled, we were moving around very much like chimps do, and we didn't have to defend any territory because we didn't have one. So if some other humans came toward us, we would just move away. There was no reason to fight. And I believe, I know you and I have argued a little bit about this. I guess nobody knows for certain. But my sense is that humans did not have anything like organized warfare until we had settled communities about 10,000 years ago. So that there may have been, I'm sure, I mean, you told me, and I'm sure you're right, there must have been intrapersonal violence. In fact, I just read a couple of days ago that they found a skull which clearly had the mark of some sort of weapon. So clearly somebody had killed this person, and this was, I mean, something like 30, 40,000 years ago, so before agriculture. So there must have been killing, but I don't think anything like organized warfare. I think the origin.
Well, we weren't organized until 10,000 years ago.
That's right, we weren't.
So it a little bit begs the question, but did clans fight with each other?
I don't think so, Peter. I think what they did, like an orca, they would simply move away. Okay, here we've met, and you know, we can't speak to each other. I don't know who you are. I don't know what you intend to do, but I'm not taking any chances. Come on, family, you know, my 20, 30 relatives, let's leave. And they would leave.
The Native Americans, who are a little bit newer in time here, the estimates are, they vary from what, I think 10 to 15,000 years ago, sometimes a little later, depending on where you think they came from. But by the time Europeans got to describe them, they were frequently at warfare with each other. There were exterminations of one tribe by another, as far as I can tell. And in fact, the Iroquois Confederation, which became somewhat of a model for Jefferson and Ben Franklin of how to organize a country, the Iroquois Confederation was set up precisely to stop the wars between all the Iroquois nations. So we have that going on by the time we get to look at our country. That's a tough one.
That's much, much later, Peter.
It is. But they still had room to move around. This was not a densely settled country when they arrived.
They had room to move around, but they also had, I mean, they weren't just roving. They had settled communities.
Many did, yes.
And, you know, we don't have, of course, a lot of evidence for what happened 30, 40, and 50,000 years ago. It's very hard to say. But, I mean, the people who do look at hunter-gatherers today pretty much acknowledge it's very rare for them to engage in any kind of warfare. I mean, they can be, there's intrapersonal, but nothing of an organized nature.
I want to shift us, and because I think this is very interesting, but I think we've probably exhausted the data. I want to shift, and we got a couple of minutes before we go to break, but I'd really like to shift to what have we learned from animals and dogs especially, because I'm beginning to think more and more something that I'm sure you began thinking about long before me, which is that dogs have really helped us learn to love. Do we have good studies as yet on whether all cultures had dogs before, you know, 10,000 years ago or 5,000 years ago? We know now that some cultures, apparently the Muslim culture, isn't as favorable toward dogs. But looking back, I think that most cultures did have dogs prehistorically, didn't they?
Well, that's right. Prehistorically, they're almost certainly, they were everywhere. I mean, there were dogs in Australia, there were dogs in India, there were dogs in almost every country we can think of. Now, cultural attitudes changed, as you pointed out. But early on, it seems to me that the dog was always more than merely an aid to hunting, was more than merely a sentry, that is, an animal who would stand guard at the entrance to a cave and warn us if any other animals were coming or any hostile humans. I think they always enjoyed our company, and children today and always have been attracted to dogs, especially small dogs, especially puppies. And I think when it was cold, it was only natural for dogs to sleep with us. They still do that. It's always seemed to me a miracle how this animal, who's so hyper alert, when I sleep with Benji, who's a big dog, you know, he's about 80 pounds, so he takes up a good part of the bed. But any sound in the house, and he's instantly alert. You know, his ears go up, and he's just, it's kind of genetic. There's no reason for him to be worried at any point in the night. But he hears absolutely every sound, and I think he's just inherited that from his genetic forebears, you know. Be careful, there could be danger. But the rest of the time when he's sleeping with me, he's completely at ease. He completely trusts me. He sleeps with me as if we're one species, you know. We sleep together. We trust each other. And there's great joy for me in that, and he enjoys it too, clearly. And he loves sleeping with my two sons. In fact, one of them grew up with Benji in his bed every single night. And he misses it now because we're here in Spain. Benji's waiting for us when we move to Australia. So that capacity, and of course, you know that they use dogs now for reading dogs, for children who are afraid to read in class. They read to the dog instead because the dog does not ever judge or say you're mispronouncing that word. You know, dog is just happy to have a child near him. They use them for autistic children. They're therapy dogs of all possible variety. And when a dog enjoys doing that, which most of them do, they just never seem to tire of it. So they have this outpouring of affection for us that, you know, people, I mean, the cliche is they have unconditional love. But it really is true, Peter. They do. And you know, they don't seem to expect anything in return, which is in a way quite sad, because even people who mistreat their dogs, the dogs still come back to them wagging their tail and hoping that they'll be accepted. And I mean, it's one of the most tragic things I know, when you have a vicious owner and a kind dog.
Which Jeff, we have to go to break. I'm 100% in agreement. And as we come back, I want to think more about this unique possibility that we wouldn't be who we are today as a species, as human beings, if it weren't for our early acquaintanceship with the dogs, who maybe taught us a lot about unconditional love. Talking with marvelous author of multiple wonderful books about animals, start with any one of them. I love one of his more recent ones, the dog he's talking about right now, the dog who couldn't stop loving. Is that the right title, the dog who couldn't stop
yes,
loving?
Yes, that's yeah. Exactly right.
And that's your dog you're talking about right now. So
that's right.
Listen. This is read his books, and we'll go to break. Jeffrey Mason, Masson. Hi, folks. It's Peter Bregan, and I'm talking with my friend, whom I hardly ever see, because he's in places too far away for me to go, Jeffrey Mason. We're talking about dogs and animals. You can just Google Mason, Jeffrey Mason, Masson, and you'll find him in his books. If you read any of Jeffrey's books, I think you will have a deeper love and understanding for animals than you did before. I literally just recently, within the last year, reading one of his books, The Dog Who Wouldn't Stop Loving, a dog we've been talking about today, and it just gave me a deeper sense of the value that I sometimes take for granted of what my dogs, over generations of dogs, I've had dogs since I was a child, have given to me. And I'm thinking more and more that both in evolution we got a great deal from dogs, and cultural evolution certainly, and that in our individual evolutions we often do, like Jeffrey's son, who is sleeping with that wonderful dog of theirs, and I myself, I think, was closer to for many years to my dog than to anybody else. So This is really important stuff. I feel like we're not digging. We're digging in well into the issue of violence, but it's really hard to dig into this issue that dogs are friendlier than we are, and perhaps, as Jeffrey said, it's a cliche, but it's real. Actually, have helped us understand unconditional love. Do the scientists in this field, Jeff, ever talk about unconditional love in dogs?
Absolutely not.
That's just liking. But they don't in my field of psychiatry either, so.
No. And, you know, it raises for me this interesting idea that there is a disconnect between intellect and emotion. And what I see is that, I mean, I have to say that we probably are the most intelligent species on Earth, if you define intelligence narrowly, but we're definitely not the most emotional. And you see this in people. You see people who are capable of quite profound thinking, but may have shallow emotions, and vice versa. I know people who are not profound thinkers, but seem to have profound emotions. And I think I wouldn't describe dogs as profound thinkers, but I think they have profound emotions. And this has prevented us to some extent from recognizing that in this area, they are probably our superior. And it's really quite extraordinary to think of that. And that's because we always give value to intelligence rather than to emotions. So I was thinking about this because today I was reading something about Richard Dawkins, of whom I am not a fan. And he was it was long ago in his earlier life, before he became famous at Oxford and for being the world's most famous atheist, he was a zoologist. And I just read today, and this would explain it, I once had a terrible conversation with him in England when I was writing a book about farm animals, and I wanted to try and understand chickens better. And I called him in England and said I wanted to talk to him about the emotions of chickens. And he got very annoyed. And he said, "Oh, you must be thinking of my ex-wife, Marion Dawkins." I said, "No, I know her, and I'm not thinking of her. I'm thinking of you." He said, "Well, I've never written anything about chickens, and I have no interest in them." And I said, "Well, I'm holding an article you wrote a long time ago about chickens." And I read out the title to him. He said, "I have no interest in that any longer." And he hung up the phone. And then just today, I saw that indeed, he said, "I have never been interested in animals." Now, hearing that from a zoologist is a very strange thing. But it goes along with the fact this is a man of obviously considerable intellect and very shallow emotions. He said in one of his tweets quite recently that he had been abused in his school and it did him absolutely no harm. And he wished all these feminists would stop going on about being abused because it didn't bother him at all. As if, and I mean, apart from it being highly unlikely, Peter, even if it's true that he personally was abused and it didn't harm him, hardly says anything about all the other people who have been abused. So
the striking thing about Dawkins to me is how very, very angry he is. He doesn't just disagree with the notion of God. He is just vile toward people who have any spirituality in his writing. It's like adolescent outrage.
Anybody who disagrees with him, I remember when I was at Harvard.
Let me interrupt you. It's hard for us intellectuals, Jeff. I want to keep talking about love and dogs and this possibility that they may have taught us how to love.
That's right. But you see, I think there's a resistance to this idea, Peter, because there's a resistance in humans to being displaced from the top of the food chain in the larger sense, not just what we get to eat, but where we get to see ourselves. Mm-hmm. And for someone to come along, as I do, and you're willing to listen to this, but very, very few people are, to say, look, dogs may have it over us when it comes to feelings. If I had to spend the rest of my life on a desert island with Richard Dawkins or Benji, my golden lab, believe me, there's no contest. I'm going to choose Benji,
you know,
because he has this capacity for love.
And to make us feel valuable. Somewhere there's a bumper sticker that reads something like, Dear God, let me be the man my dog thinks, the person my dog thinks I am.
Well, that's right. And that, too, is a great mystery. They look up to us with a kind of devotion, with absolute, you know, you look into their eyes and you see love. You see it. You can actually see it in their eyes. And, of course, their whole facial feature shows it, and they demonstrate it in everything they do. Now, that is a mystery, Peter, and it's something that if we could unlock that in ourselves, if we could be more like dogs, the world would be a much better place. We wouldn't be killing one another. We'd be on friendlier terms. It would just be a much better world altogether. Now, what has prevented us? That's my question. What has prevented us from even seeing this? I mean, of course, everybody who lives with a dog recognizes this. But we've not taken it seriously enough to say, let's make an actual scientific study of unconditional love in dogs and see what humans can learn from it.
Just a thought I had, which is new for me, is that the nearest thing to the way dogs love us is the way a mother loves her infant, and
absolutely,
also, to some extent, the way women love infants. When,
yes,
when I go out with my wife, who is at least as smart as I am, and in many, many areas more smart, Ginger, I'm astonished to see this incredible expression of joy on her face, and she just happens to notice a sleeping infant in the next table in somebody's arms.
Absolutely.
That's maybe the nearest thing we see in human beings, is that capacity that women and some men have to just adore infants.
Yes, and you know, I mean, of course, there is the cliche that dogs are our children, and they look up, but they do look up to us as if we were an all-powerful, all-loving parent who's going to take care of them and protect them and give them whatever they want. And the only time we see that really in our world is, as you say, a mother and her child, which is pretty universal and very powerful.
Also, and older women with infants. I mean, older women with infants. I mean, Ginger would go up to and be with almost any infant she sees. I really start reacting when the child's a little older than that, you know, a year or two is when I begin to beam at the kid at the next table. But she beams at the sleeping newborn. And
yes,
so does
yes.
all the other women in the restaurant or the diner. I think that's the nearest thing where it's more generalized. So why don't we all have what women have toward their infants? Unless, of course, the woman is disturbed or oppressed or just, you know, overburdened or on drugs or whatever. You know, the vast majority of the time, a woman's going to respond to that child's smile. Like Ginger said, when she saw Allie for the first time, she was in love.
Yes.
So, all right. So we have that capacity. Men have it. Women maybe more so. I think somehow it just didn't work for the survival of the species for us to feel like that toward other human beings. I mean, because it seems built in. Our violence, to me, seems built in genetically.
I don't know, Peter. I mean, I hate to think that it is, because then it's going to be very hard to eradicate.
Oh, you thought it was easy? If we know anything, Dr. Jeffrey Mason, it's that eradicating human violence is about the hardest thing task on the face of the earth. Even harnessing it or controlling it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we do need to ask, you know, what is it that prevents people from experiencing this thing that you're absolutely correct. I see it and my wife Lila too, who is a pediatrician, of course. So, you know, when I see her look at babies with this enormous pleasure and smile, I always think, well, is that because it's her profession? But no. It's not. It's not. She adores it. She just loves looking at them. And I've learned to do it from her too. I enjoy it too. But, you know, it's some people just don't feel that empathy when they see a helpless being. They don't feel, you know, oh my God, how lovely, how beautiful, and to feel protective and to have this warm feeling inside. And people that can't feel that, I mean, it's not just, we're not talking here about sociopaths or even psychopaths. I'm even thinking of, you know, Erik Erikson, who was a very well-known psychoanalyst, very close friend to Anna Freud. And it turns out, as we learned later, long after he died, that his he had a child who was Down syndrome. And he hid this child from his other children. He forced his wife to give up this beautiful boy and put him in a home and would refuse to visit him. This happened to Arthur Miller as well, you know, Marilyn Monroe's husband. He also had a Down syndrome child that he would not acknowledge, as again we only found out fairly recently. And, you know, you can't help. I mean, these children are often such
How much do you think it's a much more male quality to reject and even kill things that are different from us, even neighbors across a boundary?
I definitely believe that. Now, Sarah Bluffer-Herdy would disagree with me, and many of the people who do research in this area would disagree, but I'm absolutely convinced that this is a male thing. In both those cases, the mother was devastated, wanted to be with the child, loved the child, and was forced by an overbearing male to not do this. And it just baffles me. And you find it even, you know, somebody like Peter Singer, who otherwise is so wonderful with animals, wrote a terrible book called Should This Child Live? More or less. And then Richard Dawkins again tweeted not long ago that it's immoral if you discover that you are pregnant with a Down syndrome to give birth to this child. I mean, who is he to tell this to a woman who wants this child? And these children are so loving and can give so much. You know, I saw a fantastic program here in Spain just a few days ago where there was this lovely Down syndrome boy, a teenager, and the woman who was interviewing was trying him to get him to admit that he wasn't quite normal and wasn't like other people. And she said, well, you must admit that you're different. And he looked at her and he said to her on TV, you're not Naomi Campbell either, you know, which I thought was just perfect. You're not a supermodel yourself. I mean, the idea that every human being is different is hard for humans to take. Dogs don't have a problem with that. Coming back to dogs. Look, Peter, when you go to a dog park and you see these very large dogs, you know, 100 pounds, 120 pounds, Mastiffs or Great Danes or even large German Shepherds, and a little Chihuahua comes up to them, they don't disdain them. They don't look at him and say, who are you? You're not a dog. They immediately want to play. They don't make the kinds of dehumanizing distinctions that we make, having to do with gender, having to do with color, having to do with language, having to do with religion, with ethnicity, with class. None of those things admit. Now, I'm sure you see this where you live, homeless people with dogs. The dogs look happy. They do not distinguish the person they're living with from any other human being. It's their friend. They don't think, gee, doesn't have nice clothes, doesn't have a home.
Jeff, I want to bring up an issue so volatile, I didn't think I would bring it up, and I don't even know your thoughts about it. But all of this also brings us back to the issue of abortion. because we so readily in our culture, and in, and even more so in the European culture, accept the unborn as not being human beings and therefore somebody who can be destroyed, rather cavalierly, actually, under the law, even in the U.S. So I think that's a part of this whole culture of our what Ginger calls the culture of death, this whole rejection of just embracing life. Now, I suspect you may come from a different place on that. And
Well, I would, but it does raise for me an area where I think we're probably in agreement, and that's the terror I have of the loosening of euthanasia laws around the world. I don't think I've read you on this. I'm not sure you've written, but I'm sure you've thought a lot about it, and I've been appalled by following what's going on in...
I have read and thought about it. I have written a little about it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was thinking about Holland, and I think that the thing is, for me, to put myself in the place of another person who's going to make these major decisions for themselves is something that I feel, it's very hard to do that. So I can't tell a woman who thinks she cannot have this baby, oh, yes, you can. And similarly, I feel torn because if somebody who's in horrendous pain and is not going to ever get rid of this pain says, I want to die, I feel, who am I to say that they're not? But I think where you and I will agree is when these are used in a psychological way, which they are in Holland, and I know that they are in Belgium as well, where they are trying to convince people who are, quote, depressed that they might never get better. And if they want to kill themselves, even if they're adolescents, and two psychiatrists have talked to them, that they should be able to do so. I find this an outrage, Peter.
It's a horror.
I mean, because, you know, if we were dogs,
yeah. I want to get back to this. If we were loving dogs, by the way, I think that a loving dog would be against abortion. I think a loving dog would be against aborting puppies. I've never come out and said that before in my life. I think that this is all about embracing life, that we see the dog embraces life in terms of living creatures, all of us, and probably most strongly embraces us, usually even above other dogs. Some embracing of life, but in particular our lives, the person they've bonded with, this unequivocal embracing of us. It's most extraordinary.
Where do you think it comes from, Peter? I mean, it's not dependence, you know. I mean, for a long time, people say, well, of course they love us. We feed them. Nothing to do with that. Absolutely not. It's something deeper than that. It's not that we offer them anything material, because, as I said, the homeless person still has the love of their dog. And it doesn't depend on who we are, you know? I mean, that's a little bit scary, that even people that you and I would not want to associate with, we see their dogs loving them, you know, looking up at them with loving eyes. And I think that's what we mean when we say it's unconditional. It's not conditional on that person being a good person, being a loving person himself or herself. It's something beyond that. As you say, it's almost like certain people who love infants when those infants really are almost undifferentiated. They're not necessarily loving us back or providing us with anything. We just love them for who they are. And it seems that dogs love us for who we are in spite of anything else about us. And that,
you know, Jeff, one of the thoughts it gave me, and I jotted it down when you were talking earlier, is maybe dogs aren't so much looking up and adoring us as gods, as I think you wrote in one of your books, or with this profound respect, love, and admiration. Maybe they think we're their puppies, and they're taking care of us.
Yeah.
maybe.
Well, sometimes
that's the only analogy we have.
We're their parent, you know, and but whatever it is, we're family for them.
Yes,
definitely. I mean, I don't know. You know, I often say, I wish I could just enter the mind of a dog for one instant when they look at us and want to. I want to know, who do they think we are? You know, what do they think? We're just some sort of different kind of dog, because they
maybe
they
think we're the little. Maybe they think we're the weak ones they have to take care of. Maybe we are their puppies.
Well,
Jeffrey,
maybe you need to take care of us, Peter.
They do. Jeffrey, I love you. I love having you on the radio show. I hope to spend some time with you at some point in the next few years, face to face. Jeffrey Mason, Masson. If you want to love life more and love your dog more and be loved more, well, probably not that, because they'll love you anyway, the dogs. Read any of Jeffrey's books on animals.